This week, we complete the Supreme Court of the United States decisions. The POTUS just said they're out of control. He previously said their behavior is outrageous. The synonym of outrageous is shameful. Is the Supreme Court guilty of shameful behavior? That is next. Hey, welcome back to the Barry Ferris Show. I hope you're doing great. You know, it's kind of hard to keep up with everything, but in case you missed it, you got to hear this. So on July 8th, the President of the United States said that the SCOTUS was out of control. And on July 9th, a group of activist nut jobs showed up at Morton Steakhouse to protest Justice Kavanaugh eating dinner there. They demanded that the restaurant kick him out. Well, naturally, Justice Kavanaugh's security detail wasn't going to wait around and see what would happen, especially since just a few weeks ago, there was an assassination attempt against him. Thankfully, that was foiled. So they rushed him out the back door to safety. Now, there are at least two groups involved in this craziness. Shut Down DC, and they offer money to any DC service industry worker for reporting a sighting of any of the conservative justices, Roberts, Gorsuch, Alito, Barrett, Kavanaugh, or Thomas. They will Venmo you the money for a confirmed sighting and give you four times as much if the guy's still there 30 minutes later. The other group is downright impolite. They apparently work together. They have ready-to-go protesters. The steakhouse actually did a really good job of condemning the disruption. They called the protesters selfish and void of decency. But what really got my goat is the indecency of the president. While he's signing an executive order to support chemical abortions, the POTUS called the Supreme Court out of control. I mean, that's on the heels of calling the Supreme Court's behavior outrageous. And he did that while he was on foreign soil. He needs to be respectful of the honorable Supreme Court justices. They should be treated with some respect and protected. But back to the accusation. Is there anything to it? Is the Supreme Court out of control? Is their behavior outrageous? Was it shameful? You might disagree with a ruling here or there, or all of them, but the Supreme Court seemed to do their job in a pretty workmanlike manner. As hard as this is to believe from the media noise, not everything the Supreme Court does is divisive or controversial. Last time we looked at five of the 14 major cases since January 2022. Today we're going to wrap it up, and you can decide for yourself if the Supreme Court's out of control, outrageous, or shameful, or maybe they're just doing their job to protect the Constitution. Okay, so there were two unanimous votes. The first was on the First Amendment. It's in a case called Shurtleff in Boston. The court ruled that the city of Boston had violated the First Amendment. Now, why is that? Well, it refused to let a private group raise a Christian flag in front of its city hall, even though it allowed other religious groups and many other organizations to use that flagpole, that third flagpole, to celebrate various causes. And since that third flagpole was available for gay pride and other certain causes, there was a problem here of discrimination. But Boston arbitrarily rejected just one flag over a 12-year period, and that was the Christian flag. So the Christian group wanted to raise the flag for 1 hour to enhance understanding of our Judeo-Christian moral heritage. It would include some short speeches by some local clergy focusing on Boston's history. The flag bore the Latin cross. The justices used a three-step process to determine that Boston had violated the free speech clause of the First Amendment. So Boston can't open up the third flagpole to other groups and isolate one, especially one that's attempting to enhance our understanding of our Judeo-Christian moral heritage. The court ruled unanimously, and I think correctly. The second unanimous decision was another First Amendment case. This was Houston Community College System versus Wilson. In this case, the Supreme Court ruled that elected bodies can censure their members. They don't violate the First Amendment when they do so. Now, first, exactly what is a censure? Well, it's just a public stern criticism. It has the effect of saying that the person who held that public position acted improperly. Wilson used to work for the college as a trustee, and that is a position of trust and public service. He was a constant critic, and when he left, he continued to critique the college. That part's protected, and he's free to critique the college as much as he wants. But he wanted to prevent the college from censoring him. And the court ruled that when he endeavored to try to squelch the free speech rights of members of the Board of Trustees, that he was wrong. The Supreme Court ruled that a verbal censure was within the bounds of the authority of the Board of Trustees. It didn't really keep Wilson from his First Amendment right, but to deny the board the ability to censor him would be denying them their First Amendment right. He basically wanted to bully the board without allowing them to retaliate. So here the court ruled unanimously, and it seems sensibly. So those are the two 9-0s. The next ruling was 8-1. Not unanimous, but pretty close. This was a free exercise of religion and death penalty combo. It's called the Ramirez versus Collier case. The court in this case ruled that Texas would violate a federal law protecting religious freedom if it executed a death row inmate without allowing his pastor to lay hands on him and pray aloud in the execution chamber. Kind of an interesting case. The majority wrote that any concern about disruption during the execution could easily be managed. They could limit the volume and the length of the prayer, and they could remove the pastor if he didn't comply with the rules. Now, Clarence Thomas, a Christian, dissented. He said that this would allow for the prisoner to game the system. He saw it as a way for the insincere inmate to create unneeded delay. The inmate in this case is John Ramirez. He stabbed Pablo Castro 29 times. The crazy thing is that Pablo only had pocket change. Pablo died on the pavement, leaving behind 9 children and 14 grandchildren. The death penalty was not on trial here, but if the case for the death penalty is that it's a deterrent and that it gives the victim's family some closure, this would be one such instance. Regardless of Thomas's argument, the other 8 justices ruled that the inmate had a right to receive prayer from his pastor in person while he was being hooked up to the electric chair, and that is that. The next 8-1 ruling was an executive privilege case. In Trump versus Thompson, the court ruled that former President Trump could not block the release of White House records to a House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The question is whether or not a former president can obtain a court order to prevent disclosure of privileged records from his tenure in office. On the one hand, you have executive privilege, and whether that should apply after the president has left office. On the other hand, you have open records to get to the bottom of a matter. The alleged criminality turned the tide for some of the justices. And in this case, 3 justices who were appointed by Trump ruled against him. Now, is that an outrageous, politically driven court? I actually think they were wrong. I agree with the lone dissent, Thomas. I mean, how can you serve the President of the United States, give him frank counsel without concern that the communications will be publicly released at some point in the future and used by a political rival down the road? I mean, that's what executive privilege is supposed to be all about. Let's alter the context just to make the point. There were a bunch of arguments in 1787. And they were made on all sorts of issues related to the Constitution. And they were heated arguments. So with the framing of our Constitution, there was a commitment to keep all the deliberations absolutely private. In fact, the records of the Constitutional Convention were kept confidential for 30 years. That's a generation and a half. And most of those guys were dead by the time the archives were available to the public. The notion was that hotly contested ideas would be refined in the debate. You could strongly make your case without fear of recrimination. So the idea of executive privilege should be pretty broad, and without known criminality should be honored. Yet, on an 8-1 vote, the case against Trump was that the privilege is not absolute. The presidential archives were ordered to be released. You know, in that SCOTUS poll that we did last time, 57% of the Republicans agreed with Thomas on this one, the one dissent. Yet those Republicans didn't protest. They didn't destroy property. They didn't interrupt people at a restaurant. Nothing like what you see when Democrats lose a case. And to restate, in spite of being appointed by Trump, those 3 justices ruled against him. Is that out of control? The next case was 7-2. And this was a case on state secrets. In United States versus Zubda, the court ruled that the government was not required to disclose the location of a CIA black site where a detainee at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba had been tortured. So, the bad guy, a terrorist, wanted to force a full disclosure of his torture. But the government said that'd reveal too many state secrets and harm its covert operators. Now, he's in Guantanamo Bay, and he claims that the CIA used enhanced interrogation techniques against him, and he wants that investigated and fully disclosed. The government has declassified some information, but it claims that it has a right to protect state secrets in the name of national security and is not compelled to provide evidence connected to the investigation. Basically, the argument is in the arena of government-paid spies. The government doesn't argue that it was good or bad to use waterboarding and other techniques, which they argue is different than breaking bones and cutting off fingernails. You recover from waterboarding, though it does give you the very real sensation of drowning. But that's not what's on trial here. What's on trial is whether you can keep our spies safe. So the seven in the majority agreed for different reasons, but Gorsuch and Sotomayor dissented. Now that's kind of a big deal. These two would never be tempted to date. Just to get your bearings, Sotomayor is the most liberal justice on the bench based on her voting record. If you saw her on a graph of conservative versus liberal, she would be way on the far left side of the graph. Gorsuch is on the other end. He's over to the right. The third most conservative justice. Only Thomas and Alito are more consistently voting the originalist conservative point of view. So, you have a sincere liberal and a sincere conservative dissenting together. In the case of the sincere conservative, he dissents against justices to his right and to his left. Now, is that the conduct of a shameful court? Speaking of shame, back to the case. Gorsuch argued in his dissent that we should not let shame be our guide. If the USA did bad things, it should be disclosed. Transparency is the best medicine. The majority believed there was too much at risk, too many state secrets that could be revealed, and that would hurt the CIA and their operatives. Too many spies around the world could be in danger if we open this case up to the rigor of a trial. And it's a terrorist, so why should we give him the right to sue the United States anyway? I agree with the 7-2 majority here. You got to protect your spies. And war is brutal, and sometimes not so pretty. But you can't risk our operatives. If you want to fix a past procedure, just fix it. Don't let a terrorist have his day in court on the grand stage. So, of these five cases, it was either 7-2, 8-1, or 9-0. Yet the mainstream media would have you believe that the 6-3 conservative or lean conservative justices are just on a blind rampage, steamrolling every case. Of the 14 major cases, we've now discussed 10 of them. There are four more. One of them we discussed in detail a couple episodes ago. That's the issue of the federal right to abortion. That's the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's where the court ruled that a Mississippi law that banned most abortions after 15 weeks is constitutional, and they overturned Roe versus Wade. Now, I allocated an entire podcast on this decision just a couple weeks ago, so I'm not going to repeat all that. At the end of the day, honor for the life of the child and respect for the law prevailed. The life of the child was never even mentioned by the dissent. The law was clear. Abortion is not in the Constitution. The ruling leaves each state to determine its own abortion rules. For the full discussion on how the 1973 court ruling on Roe was raw judicial power, and how they made up the trimester scheme just out of thin air, and how Casey invented an impossibly subjective determinant, and how neither ruling settled anything, and how a systematic standard has been used to overturn bad SCOTUS rulings in the past, and how that process was used here, just click back to episode 79. In any event, that ruling went 6-3 in favor of the constitutional originalists. The idea that you look at the Constitution as it was understood at the time. And when it's not in the Constitution, the court can't just make it up. Either Congress has to pass a law, or the whole USA needs to pass a constitutional amendment, or it must be handled by each state. This was an honest and fair determination. The next ruling was on school prayer. A friend of mine who runs First Liberty actually won this case. This was Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. The court ruled that a football coach at a public high school had a constitutional right to pray at the 50-yard line after his team's games. The court ruled that the prayers of the coach, Joseph Kennedy, were protected by the First Amendment and that the school district had erred in suspending him after he refused to end the faith-based practice. It was found that he was not instructing players, discussing strategy, not encouraging better on-field performance, or engaged in any of the other speech that the district paid him to produce as a coach. Instead, Mr. Kennedy was just taking a moment to pray while others were checking their text messages or greeting friends or celebrating or grieving. So the real question here should be, why was Oregon against a simple prayer at the end of a football game? They aren't against other religious expressions like kneeling to protest the USA during the anthem or lifting their hands in exaltation when they win. So what is the problem? They believed that this situation created a coercive environment. They think it made the rest of the team feel like they needed to be joining the coach while he prayed in order for them to succeed. But the facts just bore out a much more freedom-giving environment. There was no penalty for not joining the coach. In fact, many players who did not join the coach were given more playing time based on their ability on the field. He's a competent coach. He just wanted the right to thank God in the middle of the field after the game was over. It took about 20 seconds. This was a victory for people of faith. And it does at least slow down some of the previous six decades of rulings that were hostile to prayer in public schools. The dissent argued that people look up to their coaches and teachers as role models. Gorsuch rejected the notion that only atheists and agnostics are good role models. In my view, the real threat are the teachers who coerce their students to normalize transgender dysphoria, who accept subjective math and science, who revise history to fit a narrative that's just not true, and create racism where there is none. Anyway, back to the case. Gorsuch wrote the opinion for the majority. This was not a publicly broadcast prayer. It wasn't recited to a captive audience. It was on the field after the game was over, and people are scrambling all over, celebrating a win or recovering from a loss. And he said that the prayers were protected by the First Amendment. The school district should never have suspended him. At the end of the day, the Constitution encourages respect, not suppression, for religious and non-religious views alike. There's another victory for religious freedom, and that was the case in Maine in support of religious schools. It's called Carson versus Macon. The court ruled that a Maine program that excludes religious schools from a state tuition program is a violation of the free exercise of religion. The state of Maine pays for private school tuition when students live in rural areas and they don't have access to public schools. So Maine prohibits those same students from using this public money to attend schools that are religious. The Supreme Court ruled that Maine violated the free exercise of religion clause of the First Amendment. I mean, if you believe your kids will get a more robust or more accurate or just more wholesome education at a religious school than at a non-sectarian one, that is up to you. Maine had argued that there was a separation of church and state in the Constitution. And actually, there isn't one. That was a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a church. And he was saying that the government should not interfere with or favor any one denomination over another. That's the separation. Roberts wrote for the majority, "The ruling doesn't support religious education, but if the state chooses to have a program that subsidizes private schools, like Maine, then it cannot discriminate against religious ones. The Maine program allowed for rural families to send their kids to private schools, and Maine would subsidize the cost. But Maine denied subsidizing the cost when a parent wanted to send their child to a religious school. The two schools in question were decidedly Christian, admittedly. I mean, very much so. One of them integrated biblical principles in every subject. The other seeks to develop students with Christian worldview and a Christian philosophy of life." The dissent argued that that was just too explicit. But what really made them mad is that those schools deny enrollment to students who do not believe the traditional view of male and female. Yet, all private schools, by definition, are not required to accept all students. They limit acceptance based on a mix of criteria. So if Maine's going to have a program to subsidize private schools, they need to make it fair for the parents and their children across the board. The state doesn't have to have the program. But once they subsidize any private school, they can't disqualify other private schools just because they're religious. This was a 6-3 ruling, and it should have been unanimous. The First Amendment is explicit. Anyway, talk about explicit. Do you have energy for one last case? Can you make it in there? Just a couple more minutes. It's a Second Amendment case. It's a New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. The court ruled that states with strict limits on carrying guns in public violate the Second Amendment. Now, New York's had restrictive gun laws for a long time. Their restrictive gun laws have not reduced their gun-related crime problem at all. But I guess that's a digression. Back to the case. In New York, a person must show a need for self-protection in order to receive a license to carry a firearm outside the home. The Supreme Court ruled that Americans have a broad right to arm themselves in public. So what this is going to do is it's going to loosen existing gun restrictions, and it will force California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey to essentially rewrite their laws as it relates to guns. And it will require many other states to make modifications in favor of the gun owner. The crux of the case legally was this idea of may issue laws. These laws gave government officials way too much discretion over issuing gun licenses. The majority opinion provided a general standard by which courts must now judge restrictions on gun rights. And that's history. Basically, Justice Thomas rejected the standard used by most lower courts, which considered whether the law advanced an important government interest. The issue now will be essentially, what does the Second Amendment mean? And when Thomas takes us back to the actual reading of the Second Amendment, it's pretty clear. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What is opaque about that? So states can use objective criteria to require background checks or mental health and gun training. They can have explicit limits to carrying a gun, for example, in like a city-owned building. But they cannot exclude the entire outside world. New York had just gone too far. The Second Amendment does not limit you to the confines of your own home. So now the burden shifts to the state to justify any restrictions, and they have to do it in light of the Second Amendment. And there's an explicit protection now. This protection is very clear. The citizen does not have to explain why they have a special need to carry a firearm. It's a right. And to make his point, Thomas equalized the Second Amendment to other famous rights that come from the Bill of Rights, the First and Sixth. States don't get to remove rights. It's not how the First Amendment works when it comes to unpopular speech or the free exercise of religion. It's not how the Sixth Amendment works when it comes to a defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him. And it's not how the Second Amendment works when it comes to public carry for self-defense. The liberal bloc of the Supreme Court doesn't look at the Constitution or those rights as stable. They feel that they can be adjusted or corrected through a modern lens. So the dissent argued based on emotion. They discussed a litany of gun violence in recent times. But Alito responded to the dissent, and he said, recounting mass shootings was not persuasive. None of those horrific acts of violence would have been deterred with more gun regulations. In fact, ironically, in Buffalo, New York, the recent mass shooting was not stopped where the law prohibited the carrying of any firearm in public. The law prohibits murder everywhere. The evil person bent on carrying out a mass shooting still did so in a state that had very restrictive gun laws. For those of us who work in marbled halls, guarded constantly by a vigilant and dedicated police force, the guarantees of the Second Amendment might seem antiquated or superfluous, Justice Thomas wrote. But the framers made a clear choice. They reserved to all Americans the right to bear arms for self-defense. It's explicitly in the Constitution. Well, as a lot of cases to digest, counting last episode, we have looked at all 14 major cases from January 2022 to present. A lot of interesting legal arguments. But the question on the table is pretty straightforward. Is the President of the United States correct that the Supreme Court is guilty of outrageous behavior? Are they out of control? The data paints a more placid picture. 43% of the cases went with the 6-3 conservative or lean conservative jurists. 36% were ruled in a super-duper majority, 7-2 or 8-1 or 9-0. And 21% were decided in a 5-4 split. And 67% of those went with the liberal view of the court. These stats alone don't argue that the court was sensible, but their written arguments do. The truth of the matter is the president only honors the Supreme Court when they agree with him, only when they rule from a progressive perspective. He can think however he pleases, but thankfully he doesn't get to decide. The president needs a refresher course on eighth grade civics. The president is the head of the executive branch, but the Congress, made of the House of Reps and Senators, they make up the legislative branch. And the SCOTUS and all the judges under them, that's the judicial branch. They are designed to be co-equal in power. The SCOTUS does not report to Biden. Regardless of the POTUS's temper tantrum, the SCOTUS is designed to protect the Constitution. It's deliberately structured to be insulated from the whims of the public or the political pressure from other branches of government. The people elect Congress and the executive branch. The Supreme Court is intentionally appointed. That enables them to filter out mob noise and do the work of upholding the Constitution and being the final arbitrator of lower court rulings. The POTUS needs to remember that we do not live in a pure democracy. A pure democracy is where the majority always rule. This can result in effectively a dictatorship. A thin majority, such as we have now in the Senate and the House, could make all the rules in a pure democracy. And the minority right now in the United States is about 50%. But thankfully, we are a constitutional republic, and that prevents a pure democracy from becoming a dictatorship. For example, the filibuster is a tool that allows the minority in the Senate to slow things down. The Electoral College keeps small states relevant. But the most fundamental constitutional republic structure are the three co-equal branches of government. And the Supreme Court is different from the other two by design. They don't run for office. They never seek re-election. They serve as a powerful check and balance against the executive and legislative branches of government. The president should not have denigrated another branch of government on foreign soil. He was wrong to do so. That was shameful, even out of control. But I'm sure grateful that our constitutional republic has a mechanism to put a check on his power to your freedom.
Hi, I'm David Farah. Thank you for listening to my dad's podcast, The Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Click subscribe now to be sure you don't miss an episode. Share this podcast with your friends on social media and give The Barry Farah Show your 5-star rating. See you next time.